Dr. William Luther Pierce, 2001, on Awakening.
Hello. First today, I want to correct the misstatement I made 2 weeks ago in my broadcast of November 17th. In that broadcast, I said that the Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, who instigated the murder of thousands of Palestinian women and children in Lebanon in 1982, is being sought for trial by the International Court of Justice in The Hague, the same international court that succeeded in extraditing former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic for trial on charges of crimes against humanity in Kosovo. Actually, the charges against Sharon haven't made it to The Hague yet. Charges have been brought against him in Brussels by survivors of the 1982 massacre, however, and the public prosecutor in Brussels made a decision earlier this year that the evidence against Sharon is sufficient to begin court proceedings. A few days ago, a summons was issued by a Belgian court for Sharon to appear at a hearing on genocide charges. Both the Bush government in Washington and Sharon's own government are applying enormous pressure to the Belgian government to stifle the proceedings against Sharon, but to date, the legal process against him is proceeding. That in itself is remarkable in an era when Jewish influence reaches nearly everywhere in the white world. Now, today's topic. For 35 years, I have devoted nearly all of my waking hours to an effort to inform and inspire white Americans and other Europeans around the world. I began in 1966 by publishing and distributing leaflets and pamphlets and tabloid newspapers in Washington. My basic message then was the same as it is now. One part of that message is that the Jews are our misfortune. We made the terrible mistake of letting them infiltrate our society in America and in Europe. They began taking over our mass media of news and entertainment as soon as they stepped off the boat. In the early years of the last century, they headed straight for Hollywood and, working together, elbowed nearly all of their non-Jewish competitors out of the movie business. In New York and Washington, they seized control of the nation's most influential newspapers and magazines. In every country in Europe, they organized communist parties based on the political theories of their fellow Jew, Marx, and they fomented wars and revolutions aimed at destabilizing Gentile societies so that they could gain more power, more control. In Russia, in 1917, they finally succeeded in toppling a Gentile government and imposing their will on an entire Gentile nation. And then they selectively murdered tens of millions of Russians and Ukrainians. After the start of the Second World War, they continued their murder campaign in the Baltic states and in Poland, selectively rounding up and killing the best people, the most successful people, the most intelligent and creative and active people. They attempted to decapitate every Gentile nation they could, to eliminate opposition to their rule. In 1966, I began publishing information about the Jewish role in communism and about the terrible crimes they committed against our people in Europe. In 1968, I published the first edition of my documentary article on the Jewish control of the news and entertainment media in America, naming the key Jews and explaining how they use their media control. It's called Who Rules America, and I've updated it and republished it nearly every year since then. I've explained over and over and over again for more than 30 years how Jewish media control has led to the total corruption of our political process and our government. The politician who gets the most votes wins a position at the public trough. the opinions of the majority of the voters and their attitudes toward political candidates are manipulated by the mass media, and the Jews control the mass media. I've pointed out the Jewish role in dozens of destructive governmental policies in the United States. Immigration policy, for example. In the 1950s and 1960s, the Jews pushed for switching the flow of immigrants into the United States from Europe to the Third World. They pushed for fewer white immigrants and more brown and black and yellow immigrants. And after they succeeded in that, they pushed for keeping our borders open to the Third World, resulting in the continued racial darkening of America. And among themselves, they talked about why this was important to them. They talked about the need to dilute the European majority in America in order to make America easier to control. They used their old tactic of divide and rule. And I've talked about the Jewish role in changing the standards in American education, about the Jewish role in pushing for racial mixing in our society and for more miscegenation between whites and non-whites. I've talked about the Jewish role in hate crime and speech crime legislation and about the Jewish role in attempting to abolish the Second Amendment. But Jewish media control and Jewish communism and the Jewish role in the destructive governmental policies that have afflicted America are not my whole message. They are just a part of it. I also have been talking and writing for decades about our own people's non-resistance to the Jewish evil inflicted on them. I've talked about our own people's collaboration in the Jews' destruction of America and our people. It wasn't long after I'd started writing and preaching to the public that I began to understand that most of the public is completely impervious to any message that doesn't come to them through TV. The only thoughts they permit into their heads are thoughts that they believe are in the heads of their peers. These are the lemmings, and it simply isn't worthwhile trying to talk to them until one can do it through a medium comparable in power to the media in the hands of the Jews. After I realized that, I addressed my message only to that portion of our people able to think independently of the masses. And even here, I was disappointed. I wrote and spoke about things of fundamental importance for the survival of our race and our civilization, and the response was minimal. That is, although many people agreed with me theoretically, very few were willing to do anything. In some cases, it was fear. They were afraid of the government, even though the government was much less fearsome in those days than it is now. More often, however, it was simply a lack of interest. People understood what I was saying, more or less, but their response was, so what? They were relatively comfortable and secure, and the things I was talking about seemed too impersonal, too remote. They didn't believe these things would impact their personal lives severely enough to warrant their taking action along the lines I suggested. I told them about the Jewish control of the mass media, and most of them believed me because I gave them names and other specifics they could check for themselves. I told them that allowing the Jews to exercise such power over our people would lead to our destruction. They shrugged and figured I was exaggerating. They thought that they would control what their own kids watched on TV, and that would take care of the problem. No need to do anything drastic. Well, I kept preaching, and I continued to develop new media for my message. Radio, the internet, music, video. The response to my message grew, but very slowly. I tried every way I could to stress the importance of what I was saying. I used very emphatic language, sometimes shocking language. I didn't want to risk losing credibility by exaggerating, but I did try hard to catch people's attention and make them think about what I was saying. And I did more than just talk and publish. One subject I preached long and hard about from the beginning was the danger of the United States continuing to provide military, financial, and diplomatic support for the gangster state of Israel. I warned that supporting Israel was not in accord with America's interests, that it was only making the people from whom we needed to purchase petroleum hate us, and we were getting nothing in return from Israel except contempt. Indeed, I put a great deal of effort into publicizing Israel's treacherous attempt in 1967 to sink the U.S. Navy ship, the USS Liberty, and kill the crew so that it could be blamed on Egypt, against whom Israel was waging war at the time. Then in 1973, when Israel was involved in another war against both Egypt and Syria, I sued the U.S. Secretary of Defense in a federal court in an effort to block the illegal shipment of U.S. tanks, aircraft, and other weapons to Israel. I invited others to join me in this lawsuit. This was a concrete thing people could do. If the United States could be made to stay out of the war, then Israel would lose, and our Jewish problem in the Middle East would be solved. But in order to be effective, my lawsuit needed much support. It needed some big names behind it so that the media couldn't ignore it. It needed a whole army of high-profile lawyers prosecuting it so that the courts couldn't ignore it. And the lawyers meant money, of course. The suit itself was on firm legal ground. The Secretary of Defense could not legally send U.S. tanks and planes to Israel without specific authorization from the Congress, which he did not have. And the Jews needed the weapons immediately in order to avoid defeat by the Egyptians and the Syrians. Well, the big names I wanted to associate with my lawsuit refused to come forward. They were much more concerned with not offending the Jews than with eliminating the festering sore in our side that was Israel. And neither the money nor the high-profile lawyers needed to make the federal court pay attention to my suit came forward. And so the Jewish Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger, airlifted to Israel the weapons for which the Jews were clamoring. He drew down our military stockpiles in Europe to dangerously low levels in order to give Israel the weapons needed to defeat her neighbors. All of this was in the middle of the Cold War, when the U.S. defense of Western Europe against the Soviet Union was a serious matter. The Congress later gave Schlesinger the authorization to do what he had done after the fact. But when he began doing it, he lacked that authorization, and a strongly prosecuted lawsuit could have delayed the shipment of arms to Israel. I had put all of my own money into the effort to hold up the diversion of U.S. weapons to Israel at least long enough to give an advantage to Egypt and Syria, and no one would help me. Anyway, for my efforts, I had a valuable lesson in the way the judicial system works in America. It's not about justice and right and the law. It's all about power and money. I also had yet another reminder of what I already had learned about the lack of any real sense of responsibility, even among thinking Americans. I'm sure that many of those who refused to help me with my lawsuit in 1973 thought of themselves as patriots. They just didn't take seriously my warning about the dangerous consequences for America of continuing to permit the U.S. government to support Israel's aggression against her neighbors. In 1975, I tried a new medium for my message. I wrote a novel which I named The Turner Diaries. I looked at the trends I saw in 1975. The increasing meddling of the government in people's lives, the increasing effort by the government to control not only what people did with their own resources, but also what they said and thought, the increasing favoritism shown to non-white minorities by the government, the increasing compulsion toward mixing of the races in the schools, in the workplace, in residential neighborhoods, and the growing alienation of the white population, the growing tendency to shrug off any sense of responsibility, to withdraw into oneself and seek only one's own pleasure and comfort while everything else went to hell. I looked at these trends, and I tried to project them ahead 20 years. I tried to imagine what life in America would be like in the 1990s. And that's what I wrote about in the Turner Diaries. And the book was successful beyond my wildest dreams. No major publisher would touch the book, of course, and I had to publish it myself. After it was published, bookstores wouldn't carry it, and reviewers wouldn't review it. I had to advertise it and sell it myself. And despite all the obstacles, it sold like hot dogs at a ball game. I was amazed. Hundreds of thousands of people bought the book and liked it and told their friends about it. It was translated into German and French and Swedish and Polish and Romanian. Last week, a Polish visitor told me that the Polish edition of the book is being sold now at newsstands and railway stations in Poland. But the governments in Germany and France and Canada and Britain went to the trouble to ban the book, and people who try to sell the Turner Diaries in those countries can be imprisoned. But people still wouldn't do anything. People read my book as escapist fiction because they enjoyed the action I wrote about. But almost no one really took it seriously until very recently. The book was too far-fetched to be taken seriously. It didn't seem real. They couldn't imagine that the projection of the future I made back in 1975 ever could come to pass in America. After all, I wrote about an America with a much more repressive government than Americans ever had experienced. I wrote about an armed uprising against the government by white patriots. I wrote about domestic terrorism on a huge scale. I wrote about patriots using truck bombs to blow up government buildings, about patriots obtaining nuclear weapons and then putting one in an airplane and flying it into the Pentagon on a suicide mission. It just didn't seem real. Readers enjoyed it but didn't take it seriously. And it wasn't just the action in the Turner Diaries they didn't take seriously. They thought my message was too extreme. They thought I was being excessively harsh in my portrayal of governmental corruption and of treason by the politicians. Things are bad, they agreed, but not as bad as I portrayed them. They thought the racism and the anti-Semitism of the characters in the book were too fanatical. They thought that the ethnic cleansing that was described in the book was unnecessarily bloody and cruel, until very recently. But now I am detecting a changing attitude toward my book on the part of the most perceptive and most independent-minded readers. The attitude of the lemmings hasn't changed at all, of course. They're not about to be seen reading the book because they've been told by their TV that it's a very politically incorrect book, a very hateful book. But thinking people are looking at it again and reconsidering their initial judgment that it's too extreme, too unrealistic. They have seen too many of the things I wrote about in 1975 come to pass. Or at least, they are seeing persuasive indications now that some of the far-fetched things I wrote about may come to pass soon. And it's not just my book, The Turner Diaries, that they are re-evaluating now. They're rethinking everything that they had taken for granted before. They are taking things seriously now that they didn't pay much attention to before. Until very recently, most Americans, even thinking Americans, didn't take the government's foreign policy very seriously because it seemed too far from home. They didn't believe that what the government did overseas could have much effect on their personal comfort or security. Now they understand that it can. In September, it was brought home to them that a bad foreign policy can have disastrous consequences right here in America. And it's not just that they understand that Americans can be bombed and hijacked and infected with anthrax by people who have been driven to desperation by our foreign policy. They have seen the U.S. government's response and the media response to what happened in September. They have heard the barefaced, brazen lies from everyone in the government and the media to the effect that the September 11th attack was unprovoked, that it had nothing to do with the government's support of Israel against her neighbors, that it was based only on an irrational hatred by fundamentalist Muslims of America's freedom and democracy, and, as Mrs. Bush claimed recently, on their desire to oppress American women. I have been claiming for years that the government in Washington is totally corrupt and totally under Jewish control, and nearly everyone took those claims with a grain of salt. It is true that the Jews are powerful and have much political influence, they thought, but certainly Pierce is exaggerating. Certainly there still are some patriotic politicians in the government. Certainly the Jews don't control everything in Washington the way Pierce claims they do. After all, our government often is critical of Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian land. Our government has criticized the programs of assassination and terrorism the Jews are using against the Palestinians. Often there are public arguments between Israeli politicians and Washington politicians. So surely Pierce is exaggerating. Now, however, these people who were sure that I have been exaggerating are noticing that, despite the public show of criticism and disagreement, U.S. money and weapons somehow keep going to Israel year after year. They are noticing that, while there undoubtedly are a few minor agencies of the government in Washington that the Jews don't have their noses in, the Jews do seem to get their way with everything that is really important to them. The doubters are noticing that in a matter as important to America as the September 11th attacks, everyone in the government and the media continues to support Israeli interests instead of American interests. No one will condemn Washington's Israel First policy that led to the attacks. The doubters are noticing that instead of acting to secure America's interests now, we are beginning a major war in the Middle East in order to secure Israel's interests. Finally, thinking people who could not accept my blanket condemnation of Jewish influence on European and American society, people who objected that not all Jews had been communists back during the rise and triumph of communism, and not all communists who participated in genocide against the people of Eastern Europe were Jews, people who objected that not all Jews in America are involved in the filth coming from Hollywood now. Not all Jews are working to abolish the Second Amendment. Not every single Jew is pushing to keep America's borders open. These thinking people are beginning to understand that it is the collective influence of the Jews on our society that is dragging it down. It is dawning on them that the most important of the destructive influences in the life of our race are Jewish influences, whether every Jew is involved in these influences or not. They are understanding that we no longer can afford the luxury of quibbling over just what the role of this Jew or that Jew has been. We must act to end the overall Jewish influence, the collective Jewish influence. And if we are to survive, we must do it soon. Perhaps I am too much of an optimist, but I do believe that after all of these years of preaching, I am seeing the beginning of an awakening among thinking Americans now, the beginning of a new contact with reality. And perhaps this awakening to the reality of our situation will lead some thinking Americans to begin accepting some responsibility for the future of our people. Thanks for being with me again today.